Ready for an invasion? It's the Pitch Invaders Podcast. And now, your hosts, Tom Quinlan, Brian Speaks, and Will Blasini.
Is this
seriously Jamiroquai?
No, it's Jennifer Hudson.
Jennifer Hudson?
This is Jennifer Hudson and R. Kelly.
Some pop, keep on singing.
What's going on? Thursday, November 20th, 2014. Welcome to the Pitch Invaders Podcast. I am Tom Quinlan. Will Blasini.
2014, everybody.
As if we already didn't know that we were in the 2000s as of 14 effing years ago.
Well, it's a reminder.
Well, also, obviously,
1914. Oh, this is actually a really sad year. 1914, 100 years ago, we started one of the bloodiest conflicts in the world.
We did.
So,
Tom, what would that be? What conflict would that be? History question.
Would be a world war.
Yeah.
World War One. Okay, there we go. I was gonna say, be more specific. There were two. You can't just say the world war.
Did I say we have Kellen Rowe on the show today?
No,
we have Kellen Rowe. Well, we have Kellen Rowe on the show.
Well, what people don't know is that we've already had Kellen Rowe.
Ha ha!
I just screwed up the whole production.
You did.
It's all right. It's okay.
I'm still getting used to the fact that we've been doing that lately. It's kind of it throws me off.
What, the hello Kellen Rowe?
No, the
we'll interview somebody before the pod, and then we actually do the pod.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, whoa, hold
it
on.
It makes me confused, and I get scared and recluse into my
but
show.
But we at least know what our guests are going to say, so we don't sound like morons trying to predict.
But I'm just like a creature.
But I like being a moron.
I'm just a creature of habit, it's real. Yeah. I mean,
as someone who my job when I'm not here with Larry and Mo, I work what.
So you're curly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I'm 100% God, yeah, he's curly.
Do you see the hair? I have the shaved head.
The best part is curly. You're Larry and I'm Mo, is it?
No, I think it might have to be. No, actually, yeah, I think you might be Larry and you might be Mo.
Oh.
But when you're not here with Mo and Larry.
I'm working at a liquor store, so it's like I spend my day with numbers and stuff and I forgot the point that I was trying to make.
Yeah,
please. I'm going to digress and talk about football again.
Yeah, let's
Kraft family looks to build a soccer stadium in Boston. This is from the Boston Globe as
Wait
of two days ago.
Wait a minute, we did
ago.
This Tuesday. Will wasn't here Tuesday.
I know. Do you know why I wasn't here Tuesday, Tom? Because of alcohol, ladies and gentlemen. I had to wake up, be at work at 6 in the morning to do a physical inventory, which means counting absolutamente todos los cosas, everything inside the stores. And I did that inside 3 stores. So I was working from 6 in the morning till 7:30 at night. For the past 3 days in a row.
But at least give us your thoughts on a soccer-specific stadium in Boston.
I love it.
You love the article?
Of course. I don't care anything about the article. I'm simply talking about the idea. I'm going to pull it back from the article. Boston Globe, thumbs up. Thanks for telling us this. But it looks like it's in a gorgeous little position there. Who needs a parking lot full of empty cars and things for public transportation? We don't want all that stuff.
Actually, the city of Boston needs that kind of stuff.
The city of Boston probably does need that. But what city of Boston needs even more is a soccer-specific stadium in the area of Boston that's close to subways, that's close to the MBTA maintenance facility. What a setting. What a backdrop for it. You know, Seattle Sounders, they have all those bars and pubs around. We get the MBTA facility, maintenance facility. Now that is amazing. That's what we want to see.
It's blue collar right there, isn't
it? That is blue collar. And it's right by South End. That gives me a smile.
And for the record, there's a subway right outside Gillette Stadium, Customer Appreciation Month.
But it's not.
You get a $2 6-inch sub.
It's an outdoor vendor that controls that rail line.
No, I was actually making a joke about Subway. That's why. $2.
Made it.
Yeah. If you actually
goodbye. Okay.
If you actually listen.
Can we talk about the conference finals? Speaking of traveling,
which one do you want to talk about?
Let's talk about first off the amazing support that's going to be shown in your arena, where there will be louder Refs fans than there will even be Red Bull fans. Right. I think that's what we're predicting at this point because we're seeing more than just 1,100 people going to Red Bull Arena so far. We're getting up to 1,200 from what I'm hearing. I mean, and these aren't people that aren't even going on buses. So, I mean, New England is going to invade Red Bull Arena. You bet your ass.
But they're not invading the pitch.
They won't invade the pitch.
I hope they don't invade the pitch.
Not like the pitch invaders that we're going to talk about today.
I will laugh and enjoy.
I guarantee you they're not going to invade the pitch because they fit in the second. They'd have to, like, die first.
They have to jump.
They'd have to jump.
They have to take a leap of faith.
Yeah.
Which I don't believe will happen. Okay. Good for them. They're showing up with lots of people. But here's the facts. Let me tell you for how much longer, how much louder the Red Bulls fans. No offense, Brian, but I'm sorry, but the Red Bulls fans for a long time have been very loud, very vocal, with a few amount of numbers and in a stadium where people don't necessarily want to ever go to. So despite the fact that they're bringing 1,200, it is not going to be a quiet arena, and it is not going to be a one-sided yelling match from the Revs fans. It's going to be a back-and-forth. It's going to be your classic, classic, great duel of voices.
Can we expect that, though? Are we going to see overall, this series, will we see fans that are going to be loud and boisterous, or will we see people, average sports fans, who are getting into this for the first time that will be on the edge of their seats for 180 minutes?
I mean, here's the problem. You're poking at the holes in MLS itself. A lot of the people that show up to games, especially in the Northeast, they are average sports fans. They are people who have been showing up in the past couple seasons. They come with children. They come with ambivalence. They come with loving European football more. They're not going to sit there and be like, Rebels, Rebels, or let's go Revs. They're not going to be doing any of that. They're going to be sitting there and be like, oh, this is a lovely game of football we have here, and it's mediocre, and it's played by Americans. They're not all going to be British, but that's just my impression and what I feel like.
Snarkiness.
Exactly. They're going to bring out their inner snarky Brit. All these fans. So it's not going to be amazing in terms of the volume, but you will expect, though. It's disappointing, but that's the nature of the beast in MLS right now.
But do you think that's just Red Bull Arena or Gillette? Because I feel like Gillette.
It's both.
You think
it's both.
So the only reason why I say that, it sounds incredibly biased of me to put Gillette on a higher level than Red Bull Arena, considering the fact that Red Bull Arena is much smaller, and I've heard it before. It's a very loud place, and I haven't even been there. It does, you know, have its...
I've heard it before.
So he's heard it. He's never been there. There's a very big difference.
There's
a monstrosity.
Here's three things that define why Red Bull Arena is a good, loud arena. First off, New York, New Jersey fans have always been known to be loud fans.
Loud and obnoxious.
Thank you very much. Two, when you watch it on TV, you can hear it clearly. It's not like you have to struggle to turn up the TV. You can hear the Viking army on the far end of the field very clearly.
Why do you have so much love for the Viking? There are two other supporters groups.
That's the only one he can name.
That's the only one I can name.
Come on. Think of the main building in New York City.
The Empire State Building.
There we go. Now, The Empire
supporters group.
Hey, there we go.
He's got two, ladies and gentlemen. He's got two.
Okay, so when you could hear the Viking army and the Empire supporters group, all right?
The third, but we'll get to that one later.
I've also heard Gillette the last couple of weeks, too, and if Gillette continues to put in 30,000 plus, which is what I'm expecting for next Thanksgiving weekend, then you have a legitimate gripe to say, well, which stadium is going to be louder? I mean, record-setting attendance numbers in Gillette for the past two home games.
Also, the one thing that you're not taking in consideration is the stadiums themselves. The thing is that Red Bull
More
Arena,
enclosed.
The way it's built, it's enclosed. So the noise level, when it goes up, it goes straight back down. Whereas in Gillette Stadium, it just sends itself out into space. you know, it doesn't amplify the noise. So in Red Bull Arena, yes, we're never going to have, even at our sold out levels, we're not going to be close to the amount of people going to a Gillette game, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be as loud. And if anything, if you got a sold out game in Red Bull Arena, it's going to be, it sound infinitely louder than it's going to sound in Gillette. But regardless of the yelling, can we just talk about the play on the field?
The play on the field is going to be amazing. I mean, when you think about the matchups, let's line them up. You got the wings, that'll be Teal Bunbury and Kellen Rowe going up against Lloyd Sam and the likes of Bradley Wright Phillips, Thierry Henry. Lee Wynn, the attack versus attack is just, that's the beginning draw right there. And then you think about the defenses. Both defenses coming into this series looked very good, but you have to keep in mind New York doesn't have Roy Miller for the next two games. So advantage New England, I'd say. And then I think it's a toss-up between both goalies right now. And it's not like both goalies rely on their offenses completely. Both goalies are capable of winning you a series. And I think Bobby Shuttleworth, if push came to shove, could win a series for the Revs if it were to rely on him.
Real quick before we gloss over this. Before we gloss over this Roy Miller thing being gone.
Oh, God.
No, it's huge. It's not gloss over. It is huge.
It's definitely a talking point. You know, at first, it didn't really seem to be, but MLSsoccer.com had an article yesterday by Benjamin Baer. This is something that I had no idea of. Since 2010, Roy Miller has logged the second most minutes behind whom? Thierry Henry. I didn't realize he played that much. And then real quick, they have
he has been one of the linchpins of our defense.
They have some stats. Their win percentage with Roy Miller, 45.5%.
Without?
25.
Oh, my God.
They give up 1.3 goals a game when he plays 1.8 without. So that's not too much, but...
I mean, it's enough, though.
It's to the point where it's less than a point and a half to almost two.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the big number in there is the 20% win percentage. 25% win percentage with Roy Miller in the rotation or even in the starting lineup. So... that is definitely going to be a concern for New York. That's a very good point that you're bringing up there, Brian.
Yeah, no, this article, like, I thought Roy Miller being gone was going to be impactful. But
no,
after
it's,
seeing
it's
that,
everything.
That's absolutely huge.
That might be the number of the series
especially
going
considering
into the series
who's
so far.
Be, especially considering who's going to be replacing him, most likely, Ambrose Ayongo, who has shown so many times throughout the season that his lack of experience has been his downfall. He's a great player. He's quick. He's great physically. But the problem is he has really serious lapses of judgment, and in a conference finals against a team like New England who is so good and has shown how good they are recently at breaking down opponents, you can't have those lapses. And another thing is that that's going to put the onus on Jamison Olave to pick up for him. And Jamison Olave...
Which is bad because he's
on his last legs. He's a phenomenal defender. No one can say that. One of the best defenders in the past couple of years.
Red card waiting to happen in this situation.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
It's absolutely true. They're going to put so much focus on Olave, who is a hothead. And also with Ayongo, he just played 90 minutes with the Cameroonian team. He's going to be flying from Cote d'Ivoire to New York. Like, he's going to be tired.
Probably today. He's probably on the flight right now. What's up, Ayongo? How's that flight? You want some in-house peanuts?
Yeah. And we'll actually talk about that game a little more later when we talk about a pitch invasion gone wrong.
Yeah.
Segue. But that's going to be tough. I mean, outside of Ayongo, the only other person I could think of they have is Connor Ladd, who's played more games this year with the New York Cosmos than he has the New York Red Bulls.
Yep. Yeah, indeed. And, you know, we saw Connor Ladd last year. He was a bit more of a factor on the team. He had his moments of brightness, but, you know, he's a small, really small guy. He's teeny. I don't trust him. And not that I don't trust small people, just this one.
Oh, my God. You're going to start anyways, a fire. That's...
Anyways, all I really hope to see, though, is that on the game on Saturday, I hope to see a repeat of September 17th, 2005. Melee in the Meadowlands, round two.
You don't play in the Meadowlands anymore.
I know, but...
So it is now Red Bull Arena. It's not the Meadowlands. And now
Jesus,
it's...
the whole point was to say that there's just a battle and it's in New Jersey, okay?
It's coming.
Jersey is basically three-fourths Meadowlands anyways, isn't it?
I would agree with that, yeah, actually. When
all right,
you look
fine, sorry. Three-fourths radiation, one-fourth Meadowlands.
Wait. There's a whole bunch of shit in there you're not accounting
for. One-third okay, one... Jimmy Hoffa.
Okay.
I think it's 1/16th Jimmy Hoffa.
Anyways, the game I'm referring to, though, 2005, September 5th, 17th, the score was 5-4 Metro Stars over Revolution. Can you tell me some of the players that were in that game? Anyone?
Mike Petke, Jay Heaps, Taylor Twellman, Steve Ralston.
Are they like...
Charlie Joseph.
Yeah. Yep.
Clint Dempsey.
Yep.
Matt Reese. No, yep. No. Nope. What, Matt Reese was in there?
Yep. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael...
Parkhurst. Okay.
And how about for the Metro Stars? What do we got here?
You got me past Petke. That's
Jeff Agos, Michael Bradley, Michael McGee, Tony Miola,
Mike McGee,
Eddie Gavin,
Miola.
And you're forgetting about the Frenchie himself, Yuri Djurkaev, the superstar.
How could you forget him?
How could you forget him? About the superstar
Yuri.
Frenchie?
It's right on the tip of
that
the
up. Sorry, Yuri.
Anyways, yeah, round two.
How were the Well, no, actually, we'll save that. Pitch Invaders podcast. We got Kellen Rowe on in a couple of minutes.
Sorry. We just footsied.
That's cute. Actually, speaking of Kellen Rowe would actually be a perfect transition into what I want to talk about. And that is how the Revs were built over the course of 3 years here. And it is a testament to Mike Burns why this team is so good. Okay? About four and a half years ago now, when Mike took over this team, the organization needed a direction. And more specifically, I thought about this last night, they needed a guy with solid U.S. men's national team connections as a former player to build the future of the franchise. Now let's look at the New England Revolution in threefold here. How they draft, how they bring players in, and how their academies are. Well, their academy is regarded as one of the best in the nation. Two of their academy players are currently playing on the Revs. And Scott Caldwell and Diego Fagundes. So to have academy players playing in MLS today automatically makes you successful. So that's one. Two, if they continue to win in the fashion that they have, they're going to look like draft day geniuses. Because think about the guys that they've built up through the years here and how they've contributed to this roster. Kellen Rowe, who Brian Bolello has said to me numerous times, might be the best player in his class. Andrew Farrell, probably the best defender of his class. Lee Wynn. AJ Soares. Lee was brought in from Vietnam. So he was not technically drafted.
He was not brought in from Vietnam. He was brought in from the Vancouver Whitecaps.
But he played in the Vietnam League. Thank you. I got that screwed up. I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. We forgive you.
Thank you.
I'm not forgiving.
Scott, who's also considered a draft pick. Mullins, Newman. So there you're good. And then, should you go another 13 months with Jermaine and everything goes well there, and New England finds themselves in a similar position next November, maybe you sign another designated player going into 2016, which will cool off the soccer-specific stadium talks, for another couple of years, because if you're winning, people aren't going to care about a soccer-specific stadium. At the end of the day, Mike Burns has done his job as general manager. So when I look to the overall success of the franchise, yes, you credit Brian Bilello for doing what he's done as president and getting fans and the community more involved. But specifically for the on-field play, you got to credit a lot of what Mike has built here for the last couple of years.
You can credit it, but it sounds as if you're crediting it more to college soccer, which I disagree with.
I don't think it necessarily goes through college soccer. I mean, me and Will have been
Jermaine was a designated player. Jermaine came from Germany. Diego didn't go to college, and Diego's considered, still, even though he's had the drop-off in goal production and minutes this year, considered one of the...
More like a plunge.
Well, he finished...
Ladies and gentlemen, that was not me. That was Will Blasini.
Finished second in team scoring this year, though. My point is that he's still one of the faces of this team and of this league, like it or not. So they have worked themselves well into different areas, the refs have. Now, you disagree here, guys, so I'll let you vent it off.
Well, it's not that I disagree. So here's the thing. Over the last 3 years, the Revolution have built a really, really solid team with a lot of really young talent. And they have done that through the college draft, which me and Will are not really necessarily the biggest fans of NCAA soccer. I don't think it's the best for developmental... For the U.S. development long term, I think there's better ways to go about it. But while it exists, the Revolution are kicking the crap out of the Super Draft every single year.
Every year.
I mean, 3 years ago, Kellen Rowe, number third pick. Last year, Andrew Farrell, number one overall. This year, number four overall, Steve Newman. Number 11 overall, Patrick Mullins. I mean, those are four impactful players. When then, yes, you add your Scott Caldwells as a homegrown player who, you know, went to the University of Akron and won two collegiate titles there. I mean, great college player turning into a great professional player. The Revolution have done that well. They also have been able to get players on the free, like Lee Wynn, like Daigo Kobayashi, you know, who have been super important. I mean, if you take Lee Wynn out of this team, you have next to nothing, ultimately. And I hate to put it like that, but this team is totally different without what Lee Wynn's been able to do. And really, they got it over from a faux pas from Vancouver. Like, that's what it comes down to. Like, Vancouver just cut ties with him over some stupid internet thing.
And then you now arrive to this point here where a year ago you're eliminated in the conference semifinals to the eventual champion Sporting Kansas City. And now you're in the conference finals this year to facing off against New York, last year's Supporters Shield winners.
What we've just done is we've neglected the fact that last year this team... success was based on the fact that they were able to make a trade with Chivas USA to get Juan Agudelo. You know, yes, he's not here anymore, but that's still impactful, and that's something they were able to do from building this team. Like, that was a front office move.
That's a good point. I really didn't think about it like that, because the first thing that especially fans do when you want to give credit to a team, you obviously credit the on-field play first, and you credit the guys that create those chances and opportunities, and, you know, if you're a Revs fan, you're obviously going to credit Jozy Altidore because he's the reason why that team got into the playoffs last year, sure. But who's the ones that's behind the scenes making the moves?
Do you want to repeat that statement one more time?
Juan Agudelo, not Jozy Altidore.
Ah, okay. The guy that Juan wishes he was.
The guy that we all wish he was. So there you go. And I don't like your snarkiness on your college soccer point.
Why? All right, here's
the thing. Okay. We're going to transition. Okay. Are we good enough to leave New York and New England, though?
I thought we already did.
Well, I know we built up with the
you,
refs.
You said a minute ago that we are transitioning, so I transitioned, okay?
Do you have anything else you want to put in there?
No.
Okay. Well, I don't like your snarkiness about college soccer.
Okay, here's my gripe with college soccer.
Snarknado.
I will be Snarknado. It's going to be on the Sci-Fi Channel soon enough. Just wait. It's going to be me twisting around, destroying various colleges across
the
country.
Flipping
the devil's bird. So here's the thing about college soccer. It served a purpose up until a point. But right now, we are heading in a direction that needs to be successful U.S. soccer. The way you get successful U.S. soccer is you do it like everyone else has been doing it for a long time. That's taking kids from a very young age, and you put them through the youth system. Going to college, a lot of these college coaches, they don't know a thing about soccer, and what they do know about soccer is nowhere near productive enough.
I would say that's
a little harsh. No. They do not know enough about soccer itself to be able to produce guys that we want to have on the field that are going to be
college coaches. Will,
who knows? Who knows how they ended up as college coaches? All I know is that these guys, they don't have enough knowledge about the game to be able to adequately teach our young guys. Because for all we know, we could have let dozens and dozens and dozens of players could have slipped through the cracks because they had unbelievable raw talent but got piss poor coaching at a college level. Listen, the thing is, we are getting better at that, and the simple, very obvious response to that is look how many homegrown players are now emerging in the league. A lot of them. They're emerging because they're going through the proper training, the proper techniques to be able to produce professional football.
Here's my
players.
Counter with that, though. Diego Fagundes, Scott Caldwell, the two very different things about those guys is one elected to go to college, one didn't go to college. And when you see that both are homegrown players, you first off automatically think Diego's the better player because he went pro first. Well, that's not the case. Scott chose to go to college. Scott had the opportunity to play behind guys, but he built himself up and went to a program that was not only just a successful one, a damn good program with world-class players now. Perry Kitchen, Will Trapp, Teal Bunbury. Should we go on? Darlington Nagbe. You know, it's not like the
college. DeAndre? Akron, yeah.
Yeah, DeAndre Yedlin then.
Listen, here's the thing.
That one slipped under me last night.
Here's the thing. Getting a great player out of college is like winning the lottery.
Why do the refs keep on doing it?
Because they keep on making a great choice. The problem is
they've been making great choices for 10 years?
Here's
12 years?
How many colleges play D1 soccer?
Enough.
How many? Do you know? Can we tell? Can anyone tell me?
It's not as much as college. It's definitely not as much as college football and college basketball.
Okay, but how many are we talking? Are we talking 40 colleges?
We're talking at least 100.
100 colleges, and there are at least 20 players on 100 colleges, right? So we're talking about how many players?
We're talking about close to 20 players per team.
20 players per team at 100 colleges. So we got almost 2,000 college soccer players, give or take. That's not an excuse. That's a lot of people, and a lot of people falling through the cracks.
Have scouting now.
Real quick, there are a total of 205 D1 men's college soccer programs in the United States of America.
Even more players. At the wall.
So let's say even number rounded up, call
20,000. Tom, the simple answer is this. What does England do with all their young players? What does Spain do? What does France do? Germany do? Argentina do? Brazil? The thing is that all these, every single country.
But what are those things? What's different from those countries from America? The lack of emphasis on education. There is more of an emphasis on education in America.
No, that is being way too snobby comparing.
That's not
American.
Being snobby.
No, that's no.
Is
now,
there more of an
education?
Is there more of an emphasis on education? Hold on, answer the question.
System.
Is there more of an emphasis on education in America or in Europe?
How can you even answer that?
More college athletes. Is there more
Doesn't
of an
matter.
Emphasis
college athletes.
On American? Is there more of an emphasis on American education or European education? Is there more of an emphasis on having your kid go to school becoming
just
a professional
blatant,
athlete?
Blatant American elitism. And
how
it's
is
ridiculous.
That blatant American elitism
because
when it's true?
Because you're talking about colleges in Europe that don't put forward education as a more integral to their lives than they do in America.
We're talking about soccer. Do soccer coaches and soccer professionals over in Europe encourage kids to go to college?
No,
they tell them to go to pro.
Because they're going pro. Because they are already on a course to build a national team. Because they recognize early on in their lives that they want to go play professional
soccer.
Okay,
so what's the difference between those? So what's the difference between a Kellen Rowe, who we'll talk to in a couple of minutes, and a 22-year-old Andre Wisdom.
The difference is that Kellen Rowe wanted to go to college, and he went to college. And you know what? He's one of the few amongst college, D1 college athletes, that actually ended up playing professional soccer and succeeding at it. The thing is that you're not thinking about how many players have come out of college and gone professional and absolutely flopped. There are dozens and dozens of players.
You could say that about any sport, though.
No, you cannot say that about any sport. And the
Have you seen Ryan Leaf?
With any other sport, you cannot, with all the other sports that we have in this country, none of those can be compared on a stage like soccer, because soccer has comparisons around the world. You don't get American football or basketball or hockey or any of those sports, so you cannot make a college comparison between those two sports. It just doesn't work.
There's a lack of money. If there was more money involved, then we're comparing soccer to we're comparing college soccer to the NFL, because that's what they compare college football to. You know what I mean? If there's money invested from the NCAA into the programs, then we're talking about a different story.
So what if they invest money?
So what they invest
what's,
money?
What's the difference? What do these college players
we're
gain
talking about $50 million endowment for a program like the Ohio State University Buckeyes football team,
but what does
opposed
that get you?
To
what does that
a $500,000 program?
What does investing more money in a college soccer team get you for your play on the field?
Better training facilities, better equipment for coaches to track stats, analytics, and the one thing that I know is lacking in Division 1, 2, and 3 soccer is adequate recruiting.
Okay.
We are a country
of
over 300 million people. You want to know why Belgium, England, and Spain and Italy are so good? Think about the size of their country. Think about the size, but think about the size of the country. Well, think about how close the proximity is for these guys to meet in the middle of the country and train and work together. We're talking about 2,000 miles separating East Coast from the West Coast.
That's not that is not that big of a factor. The bottom line is that
the country
they
doesn't
have
matter?
Been doing it for so much longer. They know what to look for. The education around our coaches and our scouts is unbelievably new. We're children in the footballing world when it comes to the rest of these nations. The thing is, the college football program, yes, if you want to go to college, that's great. If you want to go to college and play soccer, have fun. But if you want to be a professional football program, and if you want to have this United States national team and this league, for that instance, push itself to be in the talking points of the greatest leagues and team in the world, then you need to have players starting off and going through professional training.
You can have that, though. But
I'm done. I'm
you
done.
Okay. You can be done, but you can have that. But at the end of the day,
college can't offer you that. No, it can't. College is not the solution to having a good national team, a great national team, and a good league.
But you're not finding me a better solution by just saying, okay, go play in
the
academy. The
solution is already here. It's academy play.
Okay, and so there's no – okay. When we look at academy play, there's travel league, right? That's really what you're getting. You're getting just an overexposed amount of games. And then at the end
Tom,
of the day,
where did everyone on Barcelona's team come from? Where did some of the best players in England come from? They came from Southampton academies, West Ham academies, Barcelona academies, Real Madrid academies, Sao Paulo academies. We're talking about PSG academies. We're talking about Juventus academies. They're coming from academy systems. The best players in the world get trained by professionals who know what they're doing from an early age throughout their life, starting at the age of 14, 13, and 12.
I get that. All I'm saying
that's
is
that's why they're so good. If you ever want a successful U.S. national team or a successful league, you have to start training players from a young age with guys that know what they're doing. And they're simply focusing on football. You're never going to have a successful league compared to the rest of the leagues and teams in the world. It won't be at that standard unless you do that road. The college system doesn't work. You have
team, you're making it like, sound like a be-all, end-all, though.
It's not.
How
a
does it not work?
End-all.
How does it not work when the college system has produced Taylor Twellman?
Because those are guys that are very much so just float to the top and are miles above the rest. We're talking about 200 teams of guys who are athletic enough to play Division I soccer. I'm sure a lot of them are unbelievably skillful.
But isn't that where the base of this conversation really is about anyways, Division I soccer players?
Yeah, the base of this conversation is there's athletic enough to play Division I soccer, which means they're competent enough to play soccer at the highest college collegiate level in this country.
So what does it that make it competent enough for MLS?
Because the only guys that actually make it to MLS and survive in MLS are a select few of the 241-ever teams that Brian mentioned and over 20 players per roster. That's a huge pool of guys, and every single given MLS year, you're only going to see 80 of those players go to MLS, and you're only going to see 30 of those players actually succeed in MLS.
Okay, but the only reason why
30,
the only reason
30
why those numbers are
over,
so low, Will, is because you have 20 teams in this league right now. You have 30
that's
teams.
That's not an excuse.
Well, that's an MLS problem. That's an MLS problem. That's not a college soccer problem.
The amount of teams doesn't make sense. These guys are simply not good enough. I'm sorry, but
how don't the amount of teams make sense? You're talking about a lower amount of numbers.
No, hold up. Hold up one second. Brian, if you were to tell me how many people come out of the MLS draft in over 5 years are actually successful, how many of those players do you think actually are?
It depends where you define success. I mean, are you talking about, are we creating the next Taylor Twellman? Or are you talking about, you know, Patrick Mullins who, or I mean, that's not really a good example because he's still a rookie. But I mean, are you just talking like the MLS journeyman?
I mean, MLS journeyman, I don't necessarily would consider a star. I'm considering when I see a successful player, I'm thinking of someone who, you know, can start himself half of a season of games, get on the field, be impactful, and then help his team towards success.
I would say probably out of every MLS draft, there's probably, you know, 8 or 9 of those players. Like, I mean, based on that, like, based on, like, I mean, if you're talking, like, that next level, like, DeAndre Yedlin, Taylor Twellman, like, players that can, you know, break out of the league, you know, maybe every other year you get a player like that.
Sure, that's fine. But what about the complimentary players that have done an enormous amount for MLS teams in the past? For example, Teal Bunbury, Darlington Nagbe, you know, not mediocre guys, but professionals that play at a high level. And we're going to go at this all day if we keep on going. But, you know, it's not like MLS has just only produced superstars out of the college level. They have had their success in producing complimentary guys who can win you big games as well. And that's all. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it at that. And if everybody else has got something to say, I'll let you get it.
I just have a problem where you threw Darlington Nagbe in with Teal Bunbury and then said mediocre. I mean, Darlington Nagbe is a superstar, and the only reason he didn't have a phenomenal season, and you know,
I corrected myself. I said complimentary pieces.
But Darlington Nagbe is not a complimentary piece. Darlington Nagbe is one of the better players in the league who the league found, hey, the only way we can do anything to get this guy is to follow the hell out of him every time he touches the ball. That's why his numbers are down. I mean, Darlington Nagbe, if he wasn't going for U.S. citizenship, he probably would be in talks to play outside of the country. But right now, he wants to get his U.S. citizenship, and by doing that, he needs to stay in this country for 3 more years or 2 more years.
Whatever the process may be. Okay. Kellen Rowe up next. Before we go to Kellen Rowe, some fun MLS comparisons with the NCAA, as much as we all hate it. If you, Brian, or Will, could name the 3 MLS coaches who've won on the NCAA level, who are they?
Bruce Arena.
That's one.
Ziggy Smith.
Dos.
And my personal favorite, Caleb Porter.
Akron. There you go.
I won.
Could you
get a prize?
Can you name?
Can we make him a cake or a cupcake?
Can you name the
miniature version of a cake?
That fits in a cup.
Can you name the Revs who have played in an NCAA final in the past 5 years?
Well, I know last year, my man Patrick Mullins was in that.
Maryland, yes, you're 1 for 1. Let's see if you. Let's see how good you are here. Let's check it out.
So we're going for 10 years.
We're going at 5 years. We'll go with a five year range.
I'm gonna check out, seeing as how I don't know much. Red Bulls guy in the room.
I know Steve Newman had a successful career with Georgetown. Would he be one?
Steve Newman is two.
Steve Newman is two. Well, obviously, Scotty Caldwell, University of Akron, Caleb Porter.
Yep, and he played in two different NCAA championship games.
And I can't think of any more.
And Scott lost in one. You said he won two NCAA championships. He won one, lost one, just saying.
Well then.
Andrew Farrell, who played against Scott Caldwell in the 2010 NCAA Finals.
Okay.
Louis Sofner, who started in goal for the University of Indiana in the 2012 NCAA Finals that featured Steve Newman.
I didn't actually know he went to Indiana.
Yeah. Louis Sofner, Indiana. And in 2009, Scott Caldwell was on that other Akron team with Teal Bunbury that lost to the University of Virginia. So there we go there. I thought Lee Wynn was on the 2004 team at Indiana that won the national title, but Lee Wynn actually came in 2005 and had his breakout rookie season on the Big Ten level. Pitch Invaders podcast. Yo. All right. Oh, and the last one is just fun facts for the next time that you're talking college soccer with your friends. Bob Gulker, the most successful NCAA coach of all time with 6 NCAA titles, and he won 5 at what college? Can you tell me the birthplace of American soccer, essentially?
Missouri.
Good. Name the city.
St. Louis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bob
Gulker.
Yeah, Gulker,
that's won. Two cupcakes.
That's two
Damn,
cupcakes.
Dude. You going to make me go broke?
5 NCAA titles with St. Louis. St. Louis, 10-time NCAA title holders, and no wonder why. You know, Taylor Twellman's always on ESPN. St. Louis is the birthplace of American soccer. Yeah, you're also from that area.
What about
so don't...
Fall River or Bethlehem?
Yeah.
Oceaneers. Yeah. Wait, actually, no, that was Rhode Island. Never mind, excuse me.
Fall River?
Fall River, the...
Marksman.
There you go.
Marksman, kid.
I was thinking Rhode Island Oceaneers.
And there's also Bethlehem in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Those two are the OGs.
We got some Taylor Twellman love for some reason yesterday. We got some requests on Twitter that we need to get Taylor on this show.
Unsolicited, which was
unsolicited.
Great. Because then we don't seem like douchebags asking people to ask for Taylor Twellman on the podcast. I've thought so highly of doing. Let's just have people say do this. No, they did it on their own. Thank you.
Yeah, we will try.
We're working on it.
The T12s.
Gosh, he only lives like 10 minutes away from here. We could buy him breakfast.
I can probably
see his
cook
house.
Cook
him
breakfast.
Here.
You know what? I'm pretty sure.
I'll cook him breakfast.
Does he have a boat out on the water?
I can see him.
Oh yeah? My God, there he is.
I can see that head.
Oh my God, it's Taylor Twellman. He's swimming in the ocean.
Now on the Allied Healthcare Expert Hotline.
Hello, Kellen Rowe!
Yes, Brad Feldman. It is Kellen Rowe who joins us now on the Pitch Invaders podcast. Kellen, good afternoon. How are we doing?
Doing well, guys. Thanks for having me.
No problem. How's things going? A little bit of a break before you get ready for New York. How's the week off done for you? Playoffs, you get a bye week. It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nice to get your legs back under you. It's been a long season. For us, it was good to relax and you know, we took in the last bit of sun that I think we're going to have over here in New England.
All right. So let's look first before we were talking college soccer before we brought you into the show. And can't not start this interview without mentioning about your number one UCLA Bruins, your alma mater. You must be pretty proud about how the program's looking right now.
Absolutely. I mean, they've been number one a couple times this season. I think maybe dropped off a couple times and then they're back in it. I think they got a good team. I was watching them and bragging to a couple guys against the University of Washington, a couple buddies of mine. So, you know, Leo Stoll is one of the best, I think, players in college soccer right now, and he's really showing it. And I've given Jorge a couple texts saying congratulations and good job, and hopefully I can see him when they're in the final.
That's awesome, man. Now, do you guys in the locker room watch a little bit more just to get away from the game and to take your mind off of things? Obviously, you're not getting away from the game, but take your mind off of things on the pro level and have a little bit of a rivalry in the locker room, if you will.
Well, of course. I mean, anytime a team is playing, you know, if I'm playing Virginia, UCLA is playing Virginia, I'm, you know, bragging to Chris if we're up or down or anything like that. If we're playing Louisville, I'm all over Andrew Farrell. Yeah, we definitely have the rivalries, and we're all watching it. It's pretty fun.
Oh, that's cool. And you're friendly with a U.S. women's national team star and a former Boston native, but a former Boston pro athlete herself in Sydney LaRue. So both UCLA men's and women's programs are soaring pretty high, so that's pretty cool. Looking, though, at the West Coast, because, you know, it's fascinating to me. Here on the East Coast, we break down soccer regionally. You know, you got your Northeast, you got your Southeast, and then you got your Mid-Atlantic, and that's how that's broken down. But on this side of the country, we're not too educated on how it's broken down on the West Coast. So does the Northwest, does the influence of the Northwest soccer culture extend all the way south, or does it work vice versa?
You know, it's, yeah, obviously the Northwest, it's huge right now, just blowing up on the soccer level, both pro, college, and even the youth level, which is great. And it does make its way down. You know, I think that whole west side of the country is really blowing up in this soccer. And, you know, like I said, it starts in the youth level, and that's just growing and growing because each city is getting more and more teams and more little kids involved, and that just grows the program so much. And you see it when the college game really starts to grow on that side because that youth level is getting higher and higher.
Do you think the system's improved since you've been drafted, Kellen? I mean, I know it's not the long season that a lot of athletes would like to have, considering how much soccer you would need to really excel on that pro level nowadays. But do you think the NCAA and U.S. soccer are starting to strive for better results on that college level?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the academy system, and I actually was a part of the academy system when it first started, that has grown both the youth guys coming in, you know, Generation Adidas, the guys coming in, homegrown, that has grown that to the pro level, but also to the college level. It's gotten them ready and prepared. So when they're stepping in, they're playing as a freshman, they're playing as a sophomore, rather than sitting on the bench for 2 years.
Right. Midfielder Kellen Rowe for your New England Revolution joins us on the Pitch Invaders podcast today. Follow Kellen Rowe on Twitter if you're not already at KRowe10. KRowe, when we started the season, you came into the year with a lot of hype and expectations considering how strong you finished in 2013. Unfortunately, you remember, go back to the Vancouver game, you were taken off, you had some injury issues, and you worked your way back into the starting 11 rotation slowly. For those that really don't know the Kellen Rowe story of this year, can you take us through what you were doing behind the scenes to keep yourself fresh and to emerge yourself as one of the leading starters on this 11 again?
Yeah, it wasn't the greatest start to the season. I think it was third game in and pulled a hamstring and you know, out for another 7-8 weeks. So for me, mentally, not really having a former injury to hold me out more than maybe a week, it was mentally terrifying, absolutely terrifying. I thought, you know, what am I going to do? And, you know, the coaches, the players, they all brought me back in and gradually worked my way in, like you said. You know, didn't start for a while, and finally when I became 100%, got my first start. And, you know, we had been through a rough patch in the season. Everyone did. And once we started winning again, it was kind of easy for everyone to get back in the flow. We got one or two wins under our belts and got a nice little addition in Jermaine Jones, who's always on us and making us better every day. So for us, you know, this last 3-4 months has been great for everyone, not just myself.
Kellen, what was the hardest part, not just returning from injury, but also kind of, you know, switching position? You know, last year primarily you played in the midfield. Now you're playing more towards the wing. What was the hardest part of that breaking into the team?
Just positionally, I think it's a different mindset out there as well. You know, in the middle, you have literally all different directions you can go. On the wing, you know, you have forward, back. You can't really go behind you because if you are, you're running out of bounds.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just a little bit positionally there. You're having to track a little farther back. You know, making 60-yard runs to get back sometimes when in the middle, you know, it's 30, 40-yard runs. It's just a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But I think I've gotten used to it a little bit, and I've learned to play inside and tuck in a little more.
You also, now in this upcoming series versus New York, would have to imagine that you're going to have to track back a little bit more, too. Can you talk about the defensive preparations that you're working towards and getting ready for New York?
Yeah, of course. You know, in every game, you're going to have to track back a lot, but it's all about the connection that we have on the wing with the outside back and the midfielder. So if I'm playing on the left, do myself, Chris Tierney, Kevin Alston, do we have this connection where if a guy runs past me, Kevin or Chris has him, if it's in front of me, then I take him. It's one of those where we can help each other out. So you're not making too many 60-yard runs. Instead, you're making, you know, 5-10-yard runs to close the ball down. Mm-hmm.
We saw Coach Heap switch you out with Teal against Columbus. You played on the press box side, if you will, you know, on the right side of the field in that game, and you guys were very effective. I mean, you put up the goals you needed to get through the first round, and it just seemed like it was a lot quicker and free flowing. Could we expect a lot of that same play from you guys in this second in the Eastern Conference Finals?
Absolutely, and I think a lot of interchange happens throughout this midfield and forward line. You know, you got a guy like Charlie Davies who can run the wing if he needs to. Teal up front who can hold the ball up. You know, Teal and I are switching sides every once in a while. And you got like, you know, Scotty, Jermaine, and Lee all interchanging in that midfield and us tucking in as well. We have such a free-flowing game that it's just so hard to defend. You can't just stay on one guy, and that's what we want.
So, Kellen, you know, obviously with this team's success, we're getting more and more people every week. You know, more people on the fort, more people on the rest of the stadium. You know, the last two home games, the Midnight Riders and the Rebellion, have really stepped up their TIFO game. Does that do anything from an on-field perspective for the rest of you guys?
Oh, 100% does. You know, it gains a little bit of confidence for us. It gains a little more motivation, a little more adrenaline, because, you know, when something goes wrong or something goes right, that little bit of a cheer, that little bit of noise really just picks you up again and gets you going. You know, people always say it may be cliche, but they really do. Those fans take us to the next level if you need. They give us our third, fourth win.
Do you feel like you guys have been able to generate more of a home field advantage this year? I mean, the win totals are through the roof. More than half of your wins have come at home this year. Do you feel that Gillette has become what Jay Heap said he would hope it would be 3 years ago when he was announced as the new gaffer of this team, Fortress Foxborough?
Yeah. You know, I think, especially as the season goes on, you start getting a couple wins, you start getting more and more believers, I believe you could say. More and more fans, and you see it come out with the TIFOs and, you know, with all the fans that are there. The fort is absolutely full and loud. This place is so easy to play for us, you know, and it's hard for other teams to come into play, and that's what you want from a home field. And like I said, it's for other teams to come in, it's so hard for them to play that, you know, we're just taking over sometimes at home.
Yeah, you guys do take advantage of that, the size of Gillette Stadium. Well, he's Kellen Rowe joining us on the Pitch Invaders podcast. And I got him for a couple more minutes here. And you're a Seattle guy. You know, we talk about your love of the Supersonics all the time whenever you come on this show. But, you know, your Sounders, not your Sounders, but the Seattle Sounders. Seattle Sounders and LA are going to have the other Western Conference final. Do you you guys are obviously going to watch it as well. Who do you guys think about that in that series?
Yeah, it's a hard battle either way. Right. You know, you have some you know, great players either side, and neither game's going to be easier. Neither game's going to be harder. I think now it determines, you know, do you want to go in the Seattle rain or do you want to go in the LA sun?
Let's go L.A. Sun, all right?
No, I like Seattle rain. Oh, man.
Well, for people that have never been to CenturyLink Field, because, you know, I'm sure you've been there for Seahawks and Sounders games, obviously Sounders games, what has the New England region missed out on? Like, what is it that Seattle does that New England doesn't, besides pack out the stadium?
Yeah, a little bit of that, a little bit of noise. It's just a little bit crazy. I don't really know. I think we're on our way very, very close to it on this side, especially the last game we played. They do have numbers on us, but I think the craziness, the loud, the fun, that's what it's all about. That's what you want from your fans. You want a little bit of wild, and I think we're getting there.
The Jesse Reese Foundation is something that you work very close with young children. Why don't you just give a quick shout to them and how people can get involved in working with you?
Absolutely. You know, Jesse Reese Foundation is, like you said, for pediatric cancer. You know, I visit kids in the hospital all the time. If we can make one of those kids smile, you know, once a day, twice a day, it makes their life a little better and their life a little easier coming forward. Right. So, Jesse Reese Foundation, make sure to check it out.
Absolutely, and we'll make sure to give the people the website as well so they can go follow. But Kellen Rowe, as always, the man. Keep on holding to the faith for the Supersonics as well. One day we'll, they will come back.
One day. Yes, one day.
All right, he's Kellen Rowe.
Such a Red Bull fan. You're such a Red Bull fan.
I can't believe you just went an entire interview without asking any questions.
And you had him.
I got nothing to say.
You're such a Red Bull fan. Right now. Just can't even hide it.